Okay, folks, quick reminder, if you need any, that your final exam is day after tomorrow, right? I think it's 1:30 to 3:30, is that right? I'm pretty sure it is, but I'll make sure. I think it is 1:30 to 3:30 because they stagger the times for the different classes, but you'll start at the regular time of the class, but it's a two-hour final. There will be 8 problems on the final, so you'll have more time than you will have on the quizzes. You'll also have more time to budget if you take more time and whatnot. But it's cumulative. It includes everything in the class, which is a lot of stuff. So I'll let you grapple with that. I will have an extra office out tomorrow for if you have questions related to especially the option part. I'm going to send you a more extensive email because I know that part still is tricky for people who've not used option pricing before. So I'll send out an email about it and have office hours tomorrow in case you have questions. So today I thought I'd take your own numbers and feed it back. But along the way, I'd like to do a very quick review of the entire class. Okay. So let's go back to the very beginning. I said there are 3 ways you can put a number on a company. Okay. First is to intrinsic valuation, where you try to attach a number to a business based on buying it as a business. The second is pricing. We try to attach a number to an asset or a company based on what other people are paying for it. And already you can see the answers to those two don't always have to match up. And the third is, especially if there's a contingent cash flow, where there's something that happens that triggers the cash flow. A patent that gets approved, a drug that gets, you could have an option pricing model. But it's a very limited case, as you can already see in the number of people who are actually able to use option pricing models. So if you go back to basics, you strip all of the different complexities down, the value of a business is determined by 4 basic inputs, so sets of inputs. So first is the cash flows you get from your existing assets. And we all know how to compute it. We compute the after-tax operating income. You subtract out what I collectively call reinvestment, but that includes net capex, acquisitions, change in working capital, R&D, whatever you need to do to create growth, and you get a cash flow. The value of growth is going to be determined by first how much you grow, that's the good side, and how much you reinvest to get that growth, which is the reason growth can add value, do nothing for value, destroy value. The discount rate is where you show your risk fears. I mean, that's the only place that risk shows up. And higher riskier firms, and you can measure risk of betas, cost, with public companies, maybe a total beta with a private company reflects a risk. And you put closure in by assuming that at some point in time, your company becomes a mature company. So you strip everything down to basics. The inputs remain the inputs. So I thought I'd do a 20-minute quick test/review of everything we've done. And I'm going to use a structure that is going to be odd for evaluation class. You know what this guy Dante is? He's a deeply disturbed Italian from the Middle Ages who spent his entire life thinking about different layers of hell, depending on the sin you committed. Now, I read the Cliff Notes version of Dante's Inferno. I didn't have the stomach for the entire book. But I thought I would use Dante's Inferno as kind of the structure to think about valuation sins. So you can think about light sins. I've kind of, the color is light red, and as you get deeper and deeper into hell, they get worse and worse. So with each of these tests, I'm going to give you a very simple example. You can do the numbers in your head. You don't need a calculator. Help me out here in terms of making sure I don't land up in any of these layers of hell. So let's start with the first layer. It's what I call the base year fixation. We all have it, right? In fact, when you sat down to value the company, you know how it showed up? Your base year was your most recent 12 months, and you felt this urge to, hey, what happened in those 12 months? Let me make sure that the future looks like the past. Not a bad idea for mature companies where everything is settled in, but for some companies, or lots of companies, it can get us into trouble. So let's take a very simple example. It's a valuation I did of ExxonMobil in 2009. I pulled up the numbers from 2008. Revenues of $477 billion, after-tax operating income of $58 billion, and they reinvested about $4 billion back. So assume those numbers are all right from 2008. So I've got the numbers. I've got a free cash flow to the firm of $54 billion. In 2009, I estimated a cost of capital of 8%. That was about 1% lower than the typical company, so it's a pretty low cost of capital. but not really low. There were companies with 6% or 7% cost of capital, mature commodity companies, and put in a growth rate of 2% to reflect inflation's effect on oil prices. So got $54 billion in free cash flow to the firm last year, 8% cost of capital, 2% growth rate forever. And ExxonMobil is a mature company. If I just plugged it into a stable growth discounted cash flow model with the numbers I just gave you, what are we going to get? Numerator will be $54 billion. If you want to grow it out a year, you're welcome to. Denominator will be 8% minus 2%. Give me an estimated value for ExxonMobil of close to $900 billion for the value of the operating assets. You add cash, subtract our debt. Whatever you do, though, the value you're going to get for the equity is going to be 2.5 or 3 times the actual market cap of the firm. Either ExxonMobil is the biggest bargain on the face of the earth, or there's something mechanically wrong or something I'm missing in my DCF. And I have only three inputs, right? Cash flow, cost of capital, and growth rate. Which one do you think is the culprit in my misestimation, and why might it be happening? Yeah.
Cash flow, you didn't reinvest?
It's actually, no, because I did reinvest, but it reinvested only $4 billion. So I did use the free cash flow, right? So I'm using free cash flow.
I would say it's your growth rate because the free cash flow is so tied to
so
the commodity prices.
I'm willing to use a 0% growth rate, a minus 2% growth rate. I mean, you'd have to move the growth rate to minus. You see, the growth rate would have to drop by an immense amount for me to even get close to $360 billion being the market cap, right?
I think cash flow, because oil prices might be higher.
That's the question. I was valuing it in 2009. Oil prices were half what they were through much of 2008. Remember, until September of 2008, before the banking crisis hit, oil prices had been soaring. They dropped back down, just like they did it during COVID. What you had was a revenue and operating income that reflect oil prices, which were almost twice as high. Now, if I put oil prices into the inputs, you'd obviously have seen it. But my point is, sometimes you miss it because you're so focused on revenues and operating income that you miss it. So what's an easy? Yeah, go ahead.
Someone said you're not connected to the Zoom. They can't see your screen. Sorry.
Thank you.
You're the only participant in the meeting.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What the heck is going on here? Did I knock people out of the room? Maybe I've joined the wrong Zoom. That's what's happening here. Thank you for letting me know, though. Let me get off. There we go. Sorry, guys. I must have joined the Zoom for my class after this one, so let's start all over again. You guys can see it now? On Zoom? Okay, I think they can. You don't want to see the chat menu because strange things can happen on there. So when you the culprit here is I used the $54 billion without checking. So if I did know that oil price had shifted, what would be a good way to incorporate that in my valuation?
I think correct the previous year's financials by using the current oil price.
That's the only place, right? Because the cost of capital, I can't move down. The growth is kind of floored at 2%, maybe 1.0, maybe even minus 2%. Unless you normalize cash flows, you're not going to be able to fix a valuation. Commodity companies and cyclical companies always check the most recent year and check to see if you're catching a high or a low. It can cut both ways. When oil prices go up a lot, you will find that everything looks expensive because you're using last year's trailing income, and oil prices might have doubled or tripled since then. Let's move on. Next one is actually going to be it's going to be a question about tax rates. So let's see what the tax rate issue is here. And all I want you to do is tell me what after-tax operating income and free cash flow you'd use here. So you're trying to value a company. I've given you the income statement for the company. I'll go through the income statement. I have EBITDA, 140 million, EBIT of 100 million, taxable income, 80 million, net income of 48 million. This company is a mature company with zero growth. Keyword is zero growth from this point on. I want you to tell me what free cash flow to the firm I would use for this firm, given the zero growth rate. So I've given you the income statement, I've given you zero growth. Let's get the easy part out first. What's the advantage of zero growth? What do I not have to compute? If I don't have growth, I don't need CapEx, depreciation, working capital. My life got simpler, right? So all I need is after-tax operating income. So my question here is, what is my after-tax operating income given that income statement? I'll give you the choices. My EBIT was 100 million. My tax was 32 million. I could use 68 million as my after-tax operating income. What's wrong with doing that? If I subtract out the actual taxes paid from EBIT, why is that not the right operating income, after-tax operating income?
You are subtracting interest expense.
I am subtracting out the tax benefits from interest expenses are reducing my taxes. If I count that as part of my cash flow, I'll be double counting the tax benefits from interest expenses. How? Because my cash flows will be higher by 8 million. I'll then discount back at a cost of capital that is lower because I get the tax benefit. So what's the right thing to do? What should I do when I have an entire income statement and I need to compute after-tax operating income?
I think keep it into 1 minus tax.
First, you compute the tax rate, right? 32 divided by 80 is 40%. You act like you pay. That's why it's a hypothetical tax. You act like you pay a 40% tax rate on the 100 million, and you're going to end up with an after-tax operating income of 60 million. That is going to then become the basis for your valuation. All those EBIT times 1 minus T's you've seen all the way through this class, that tax rate is a hypothetical tax. It's not the actual taxes you will pay because you're acting like you have no debt. That's why it's called an unlevered cash flow. People use that word constantly, and often they don't quite get it. It's an unlevered cash flow because you're asking the question, if I had no debt, what would my cash flows be? You're discounting that cash flow at a cost of capital. It reflects the tax benefits of debt. This one's an easy one. We talked about putting your company to stable growth. And you have choices, 5 years, 10 years. Let's say it's a young company, it's just gone public, lots of promise. And you're thinking about how long to let it grow. You've seen this graph before, but I just wanted to bring it out again to remind you of how quickly growth fades at companies. The median growth period for a growth company is about 4 to 5 years. So I know some of you, in fact, over the weekend, I got at least a dozen emails from people saying, you're constraining me by not letting me grow for longer than 10 years. Can I add another 5 years? I said, be my guest. It's easy just to add the spreadsheet on and adjust it. But you're already at the 90th percentile with a 10-year growth period. It may look conservative because you're looking at firms like Amazon that have grown for longer. But the fact is we can name companies that have been able to grow for long periods at double-digit rates. In fact, one of the reasons I think there's been so much correction in the tech sector, it's almost like people are waking up saying, oh my God, Netflix can't grow at double-digit rates forever. I mean, I don't know why we need this realization to come as a shock every time it happens, but it happens with every company. I don't care how great you are, how amazing your products are, eventually you hit a brick wall. Now I'm going to test you on cost of capital mechanics. I actually pulled this cost of capital calculation out of a banking valuation. And there are at least 6 mistakes in one cost of capital calculation. So as I go through describing how the cost of capital was computed, I want you to, with each mistake, trigger it, and then we'll come back and fix it. So here's how the banker computed the cost of capital. To get the cost of equity, he started not with the current T-bond rate, but with an average T-bond rate over 20 years. So you replace today's T-bond rate with an average over a long period, normalize the risk-free rate. Duff and Phelps, which is a big appraisal firm, in fact suggested that all appraisers do it. So he's following practice that had been recommended. Replace the current risk-free rate with a normalized risk-free rate. For the beta, he went to a Bloomberg terminal and looked up the adjusted beta. It is adjusted after all. Right? For the equity risk premium, he used a historical risk premium. At that time, it was Ibbotson, which used to be the service that provided historical. Historical risk premiums, just go back to 1926, you estimate what stocks have earned over T-bonds, and he got 5%. Then this company was a small company, so he added what was called a small cap premium. A lot of appraisers add that on because their argument is small cap companies are riskier, so we need to have. That number is usually 3 to 4%. This guy added on 3%. Risk-free rate plus beta times equity risk premium plus small cap premium gives you a cost of equity of 14%. That's the cost of equity you got. To get the cost of capital, he started with the cost of equity. He used the market value of equity to weight because that's what we're supposed to do. But the debt was not traded. And he wanted to be conservative, so he counted all liabilities other than the shareholders. So he counted accounts payable, supplier credit, short-term debt, long-term debt, and came up with $1 billion in debt and $1 billion in equity, 50-50 weights. Since the debt was not traded, he used a book interest rate, which is basically interest expense divided. I see the surprising number of DCFs actually use this as the cost of debt. Take interest expense divided by book value of debt. It's called a book interest rate. The cost of debt is 3%. And for the tax rate, he used an effective tax rate of 30%. Anybody want to start listing off the things that you would disagree with in calculating the cost of capital? Yes. And can I play devil's advocate? He was trying to be conservative. That's why you include all. Tell me why it's not conservative to include all liabilities as debt.
Because your working capital items already in your cash flow.
Also, it pushes up your debt ratio, right? And you push up your debt ratio, it actually pushes down your cost of capital. So if you want to be conservative, you want to be more careful about what you include in net, not including everything in debt. So you should have included only interest-bearing debt and lease commitments if you want to do it, but not everything else, okay?
I think in the first line only, I can see three.
Okay, go ahead, go to the second, yeah.
Beta.
And what would you use instead? So tell me, act like remember, you're going to run into people who use adjusted betas all the time, so tell me what's wrong with using an adjusted beta, or a regression beta in this case.
So the beta is, the used beta is for the company, from the Bloomberg.
Yeah, and that's what I'm supposed, but that's what I'm supposed to use. Right? I need a beta for the company. Bloomberg gives it to me directly. So what's wrong with that estimate?
There can be many things which can be wrong with that beta. It might be for 1 year also.
Yeah, so that I can fix. You want 5 years, I can fix it. You're giving me openings that I can exploit, right? So if you take issue with mechanics, I can fix it. I can try a different index. So let's start with the first problem. To run a beta, regression beta, what do I need? I need past returns. What's a beta that I need for valuation? I need a future beta. First thing is already I'm looking backwards to get a forward-looking number, right? There's no getting around it. Second, a beta is a statistical number. It comes out of a regression. And in statistics, when you get a slope for a regression, what do you get below it as a report in brackets? A standard error, a noise. It's a feature, not a bug. You're going to get a noisy estimate. And third, if this is the only way you can get betas, God help you, if you run into a private company, you can never. So the pushback here is, why are you taking one slice of history, no matter how well structured it is, and use it to get your beta? The alternative, of course, you know, and I pushed it on you, and you might decide to reject it, was, hey, let's use the law of large numbers to our advantage. Let's look at the business or businesses you're in right now, not where you used to be. Take a weighted average of the business, and then adjust for your debt ratio. It's a bottom-up beta, so he's used an adjusted beta. Now, what about the equity risk premium? There are two parts, right? Let's take the historical premium first.
Premium is taken for the historical period of 26 to 2008, which might have changed now.
And also, it's like betas, it comes with a standard error, right? Remember, you take an average across 85 years, the standard error is about 2% plus. So if I tell you the risk premium is 5% and I tell you the standard error is 2%, the true premium can be as low as 1 or as high as 9. Huge range. It is backward looking. And you're right, the market could structurally have shifted. And let's face it, not could have. It's definitely changed, especially as you get into the 21st century, right? More global, more interconnected, more of these rolling crises go through. I've never talked about the small cap premium explicitly in this class. Right? And if you've ever worked in appraisal evaluation, this is standard practice. Add 3% for small companies, add 4%. I personally think it's fiction. It's fiction which is well entrenched, because between 1926 and 1981, this is a historical data, small cap stocks earned about 7 to 8% more than the average stocks, for whatever reason. So even if you adjust for beta and risk and everything else, they seem to earn 7 or 8%. That's the basis for the small cap premium. That was 1926 through 1980. Between 1981 and 2021, you know what the small cap premium has been? Minus 0.2%. It's completely disappeared. We can have an entire discussion of what's happened since 1981 that's made the small cap premium disappear, but it's now gone. 40 years later, people still continue to use a small cap premium, even though the basis for it is long gone. Bad practices, once they become embedded in valuation, never leave. So what about normalizing the risk-free rate? What do we say about that? Because no, whenever the risk-free rate is too low, we feel this urge. Yeah?
They shouldn't normalize because currently they can't find an investment without risk that pays 5%. So it's.
In other words, Selvi, if I take the 5%, I end up rejecting this company and I go looking for that 5% risk-free investment, I'm not going to find it. This is not some normalizing margins. This is actually an opportunity cost, whether you like it or not. Your opportunity cost right now is whatever the T-bond rate is. You can't just replace it with a higher number just because it makes you feel comfortable. You got the risk-free rate wrong. You got the beta. Pretty much every input and cost of equity. What about the cost of debt, this use of a book interest rate? There's something so obviously wrong about that 3% that before you even go deeper, you can tell me what that is. It's below the risk-free rate. How can you have a pre-tax cost of borrowing that is below your risk-free rate? You've already violated pretty much every first principle in finance. But book interest rates can be, for lots of reasons. One is you might have borrowed the money a while back when rates were lower. Think of all the companies that borrowed money in December when T-bond rates were 1.5%. If you think about those bonds, the book interest rate might be low because you borrowed money 6 months ago or a year ago. It might be low because you have a lot of short-term debt and the term structure is upward sloping. A book interest rate should never be even an option in a cost of debt. But what if the pushback is, but there's no rating, no traded bonds? What can you do to get a cost of debt? Just use a synthetic rating and interest. I mean, we don't have to reinvent the wheel here. Take the risk-free rate and add a default spread. You don't like interest coverage ratios? Base it on something else. Anything beats a book interest rate here. And finally, on the tax rate for debt, what tax rate should we use to compute the
marginal tax
And rate. Give me the rationale. Why do we use marginal?
Rationale is because effective tax rate might be lower because of some tax benefits which the company was enjoying.
Effective tax rates could be long-term, right? But there's actually a much more direct argument.
Benefit comes at the margin.
It's interest saves you taxes at the margin. The fact that you have low tax income somewhere else is completely irrelevant because you get to place the interest expense where you get the maximum tax benefit. Apple borrows money in the US, not in Ireland. It gets its tax benefits at the US tax rate because the US tax rate is much higher. It gives it a much bigger benefit than borrowing money in Hong Kong or Ireland, which is the marginal tax rate. So I went in and essentially fixed each of these. Let's see how it plays out. I went back to the actual T-bond rate, saying, look, I'm not going to normalize something that's out of my control. The beta I replaced with a bottom-up beta adjusted for leverage. For the equity risk premium, I used an implied equity risk premium that's going to go up or down, right, depending on what market you're in. No small cap premium. But I did forget to mention that this company, even though it's a U.S. company, gets 20% of its revenues in Brazil. And just because it's a U.S. company, I can't give it a pass, so I brought in that country risk premium for Brazil. For the cost of debt, I used a synthetic rating. My cost of debt was not low. It was actually much, much higher. It was 9% because they had a very low interest coverage ratio. And if you work out the numbers with the corrected debt ratio, my cost of capital is very different and much higher than the cost of capital that the analyst estimated because of the cleaning up. I know it's a tedious exercise, but take apart somebody else's cost of capital. Play the role of, hey, do I agree with each input? Because it's a great way of testing to see the weakest links. And do this on your own cost of capital calculations. What is the weakest link in your cost of capital calculation? Because it's better that you find it than somebody else does, or worse, that the market finds it for you. Now let's talk about growth. I'm going to give you, in this case, some projections. A lot of people in the value companies get their numbers from management. And once you open that door, it's very, very difficult to close the door. Because managers are going to give you their forecast. And let's face it, managers do know more about the company than you do, so you feel reluctant to push back. So let's suppose I'm the management of a company. I've provided you my forecast of cash flows for the next 4 years. And your job is to not contest me on the growth rate, because I'm going to use my expertise that I know more than you do, but to take my forecast and tell me whether they're at war within the numbers. Tell me whether I'm being consistent. So I'm projecting a 10% growth rate for the next 4 years. My revenues are going to therefore grow at that 10% rate. There's my after-tax operating income. My margins stay stable. I've subtracted out net capex and change in working capital to come up with free cash flows of the firm. So it's a pretty standard calculation. What are the questions you're going to ask me to see if my projections are plausible and probable? First, let's start with revenue growth. What's one of the questions you might want to ask to see if the revenue growth is plausible? One is you might ask me about my past growth rate, right? If I'm growing from 3 to 10, what's happening? Assuming the 10% is reasonable, you're going to ask me about total market size and market share to see if I'm violating some basics of market share. Assuming the growth rate of 10% is okay, have I told you something about what kind of returns on capital I expect to make in the future with my numbers? Take a look at my reinvestment every year. Notice it's a constant percentage of my after-tax operating income. It's always 20% of my after-tax operating income. My reinvestment rate is 20% of my after-tax operating income. My expected growth rate is 10%. Implicitly, I'm assuming a return on capital of how much? If I have a 10% growth rate and a 20% return on capital, what is it?
50%.
All you need to do is ask me one question. What return on capital have I historically earned? If I say 12 or 15%, then the question is, what's changing here? How did you go from being this business that makes barely above its cost of capital to a 50% return on capital? Because my margins are not improving. My projects must get in. I mean, it's amazing how many inconsistencies you can build in if you're not just thinking in terms of the interconnections between the numbers. So check to see if the growth is plausible. Check to see if this return on capital can be delivered. And if I insist I can deliver 50% returns on capital, it's my company, I want to make these projections, say, go ahead. But I'll wager 4 years from now when you look back at the cash flows, they're either going to be lower than what I estimated, or the growth is going to be much lower. Okay. Let's talk about debt ratios and the cost of capital. If you end up in the valuation, if you end up doing valuations, you notice that most people in their value companies use one cost of capital, one discount rate, and doesn't change over time. Because that's the way discounted cash flow valuation was, you know, every book I read about discounted cash flow valuation said, computer discount rate, use it as your discount rate for all cash flows over time. So when you have a debt ratio that's fixed, let's say it's 10%, your equity is 90%. My computer cost of capital, let's say a computer cost of capital of 6.8% for Home Health Foods. And then I say, oh, you know what? I'm going to switch to a target debt ratio, which, you know, analysts sometimes seem to pull out of thin air. And let's say my target debt ratio is 30% for Home Health Foods. And I ask you, what's my cost of capital going to be? What's the one thing I cannot do? if I change the debt ratio from 10 to 30%. So can I just change the weights from 30 to 70 and leave the... If I did that, what am I missing? Yes? It's going to affect my levered beta. So after unlevered betas and levered, pushes up my cost of equity. What about the cost of debt? That's probably, I'm tripling my debt, right? If I have a ratings agency rating me, there's no way they're going to give me the same rating at three times the debt. And if you use an interest coverage ratio, your interest coverage ratio will definitely be much lower because your interest expenses will explode out. Both your cost of equity and your cost of debt will go up, which means I really don't know what the cost of capital will be at 30% debt. And the reason I bring that up, it's amazing how cavalier people are about raising debt. Or just raise the debt ratio. Your cost of capital will go down purely based on the fact that the cost of debt is lower than the cost of equity. Because the math is always true that the cost of equity, but adding more debt doesn't necessarily lower your cost of capital. In this case, let's say it does. Do I have to pick between the actual and the target right now? Let's say I'm an analyst valuing a company. The debt ratio right now is 10%. I think they can move to 30% over time. Do I have to pick between the 10 and 30 right now? Can I have my cake and eat it too? Yeah.
Make it for the terminal year.
Or do it over time. In other words, there's no reason I have to pick. If you want to go to the target and you think it's going to happen over 5 years, change from 10 to 30 over 5 years. It's over 10 years, change it over 10 years. If you think it's going to happen way out in the future, change it then. Your cost of capital is a moving number. If I thought tax rates are going to be 40% 3 years from now, I don't have to raise it right now. I can wait till 3 years from now. If I think I'm going to go into an emerging market and grow more 5 years from now, every input in your cost of capital can be your specific number. It makes things a little more complicated, but it also makes them more realistic, and it saves you this wasted time of which debt ratio should we use, actual or target. And you will hear that debate. And one way to fix it is to let the actual start at the actual and move towards the target. Let's revisit the terminal value, that big elephant in the room that drives so much of your DCF. So there are three, I'm going to give you three ways of computing terminal value. This is a question we've asked and answered before, but I want to make sure it's completely clear before we kind of move away. One is to use a stable growth model, which is this perpetual growth model, and the growth rate can be negative or zero or plus 2% as long as it's less than the growth rate of the economy. You can use a multiple, EBITDA, revenues, book value. You can use a liquidation value, which is basically you end the business after year 10, sell off the assets for scrap. So one way you should never, of those three that you should never use in a DCF? The multiple, right? But be ready for a really good argument because I promise you, you go to banking, they will use it. And you're going to need to really explain why using a multiple is not bad. It's just a forward pricing. The front end of cash flows is like a kabuki dance you do to distract me from it. There's nothing wrong with using forward pricing. Some of you, in fact, had to use forward pricing in your project because your company was too young. So if you plug the numbers in today into the sector, it didn't work. So forward pricing is perfectly okay, but not in the context of a discounted cash flow valuation. Okay? So let's say that I get to this terminal value of $120 million after-tax operating income. I'm going to continue to generate those earnings in perpetuity with zero growth rate, and my cost of equity is 10%. So I'm all equity funded. If I wanted a terminal value, 120 million, zero growth, 10% cost of equity, 120 divided by 0.1 is 1.2 billion, right? That's my terminal value. Let's suppose I put in a 2% growth rate forever into this calculation. What's my terminal value going to be now? So I had 120 million zero growth and a 10% cost of equity. Now I'm putting in a 2% growth rate. What will the terminal value be? Let's see if you fall into the trap, right? We leave the numerator at 120 million. You put in a 2% growth rate. 0.08 minus 0.02 is 0.06. So you get 2 billion, right? You put a 3% growth rate, it goes to, so it seems like an easy way to create value. But what am I missing when I change just the denominator?
The reinvestment.
That 2% growth rate has to come with reinvestment. How do I figure out how much to reinvest? What do I need to know? What's the missing input?
Return on capital.
I need to know the return on capital. And if the return on capital is also equal to 10%, what's going to happen to my terminal value when I put a 2% growth rate? If I earn exactly my cost of capital and I keep growing, I'm going to create nothing in value. My terminal value will stay 1.2 billion no matter what the growth rate is if my return on capital is equal to the cost of capital. I mean, you run into this on the final exams in past years. You get to the terminal value. I always give you a return on capital. Or I tell you this company will earn no excess returns. It's the same thing as giving you the return on capital. And the reason you need that is you really cannot value a company in a discounted cash flow model without taking a point of view on what the return on capital is going to be forever. In the Excel spreadsheet that you use for the valuation, that's one of the questions I ask you. What will the return on capital be in perpetuity? Because the default is it goes to the cost of capital. So maybe your company's special. Maybe it has strong competitive advantages. Maybe it's got a brand name that's not going to go away. But that return on capital is what's going to drive your terminal value. Now let's tie up some loose ends. So let's say you've done, taken free cash flow of the firm, discounted back at the cost of capital, come up with a $100 million firm value. I'm going to throw items at you, and you tell me whether you're going to add this item, subtract this item, or do nothing with this item. So free cash flow of the firm, discounted back at the cost of capital. The company has a cash balance of $15 million. Add, subtract, or ignore, and why? Free cash for the firm, discount at the cost of capital.
Add.
Tell me why.
Because in the calculation of the free cash, value of the firm, we have ignored the cash.
Tell me what I did that led me to ignore the cash.
We started with EBIT.
There you go. So the minute you start with operating income, you haven't valued anything that is not part of operating income. Cash is obvious, so I'm going to add the cash. What about debt of $20 million? Add, subtract, or ignore to get to value?
Subtract,
because it's debt that I owe, right? What if I have a 5% holding in another company with a book value of $5 million and a market value of equity for the entire company of $200 million? Add, subtract, or ignore, and why? It's like a review of quiz two, right?
Add.
And tell me why.
Because this is also not included in.
Because income from cross-holding, and should I add the book value or should I add the estimated market value? It should be the estimated market value. If you don't have the market value, you can try tricks and multiply by price-to-book ratio, but you add. And if you have minority interest of $10 million on your balance sheet, add, subtract, or ignore. And why? When do you have minority interest? What has to happen? You need to have consolidated. We consolidated. Minority interests reflect the portion of the company that doesn't belong to you. You've got to subtract. Preferably market value again, but if all you have is book value, you're kind of stuck with that, so you subtract. Add cash, because it's not counted yet. Subtract debt, because you're going to get to the value of equity. Add the minority cross-holding, because it hasn't been counted yet. And subtract out the minority interest, because you overcounted. You counted 100%. Always go back and ask the question, what have I already counted? Because it's going to give you an answer to what should I be adding, what should I be subtracting, what should I be ignoring. So the value of equity in this firm is going to be 100 plus 15 minus 20, 95 plus 5% of 20, which is 10, 105 minus 10, back to 95. So you can see the items being added and subtracted and the reason for doing it. What if I told you that this company is the target of a lawsuit, and if it loses the lawsuit, it could lose $100 million. There's a 10% chance that you could lose the lawsuit. What would you do then? You could ignore and say the accountants haven't dealt with it, but as an equity investor, the prudent thing to do is say there's a 10% chance of losing that lawsuit. I have to take the expected loss, which is 10% of $100 million, subtract it out. So again, cleaning up is what you have to do. And that's why the loose ends are so messy, because you're saying, should I add, should I subtract, should I ignore? Because there are some items that you ignore because you've already counted them. If I told you that this company sits on valuable real estate, that it's using to run its factory. You can't add the value of the real estate to your discounted cash flow valuation because you have to pick. Do you want to run the company as a business or sell the real estate? So no double counting, no missing something, and you're trying your best to kind of wrap up every single loose end. So let's say you come up with an equity value per share of 200 million, and there were 10 million shares outstanding. Value per share, of course, is 200 divided by 10 is $20 per share. And then I say, oh my God, I forgot to tell you, we just gave out 2 million options to our CEO. And those options have a strike price of $20 per share and 5 years left to expiration. It's an at-the-money option, right? What will happen to my value per share, though, after I give these options? It should go down? How do I compute how much it will go down?
You have to evaluate the options.
As options with a five-year maturity and a strike price of 20.
I think we have to use this option pricing model.
To value the option, you'd have to use it and adjust for dilution. Remember that this is now going to affect the value, and you're going to come up with the value of the options, and you're going to subtract the value of the options from the value of the equity before dividing by the number of shares. Now, the alternate approach, which is the treasury stock approach, you add the exercise proceeds to the numerator and divide by the total number, which is one. That approach, the value per share will remain 20. The reason is, with the treasury stock approach, you're ignoring the time premium on options. You're acting like exercise value is the value of an option. The final one, I won't even go into deeper, but this was the start of the class test from session 3. It's a valuation of, this is the deepest layer of hell. If you got there, there's no way out. It's like, you know, there are some sins you can't come back from. This is one of those. No confession allowed. Okay. So this is, of course, the Wasserstein parallel layer of hell, where they took the cash flows to equity. How do we know the cash flows to equity? They started with net income, subtracted our debt payments, I don't care what they call it. It's a cash flow to equity. And then discounted, not only at the cost of capital, which is the wrong discount rate, but at the wrong company's discount rate, the acquiring company's cost of capital. They used a 10.5% cost of capital when in fact they should have been using a 16.5% cost of equity. They turned a company that was overvalued by $100 million to one that looked undervalued, and somebody actually paid real money for it. So it's a very quick review, but kind of review those pages because it kind of hits all these mechanical details that start to build up over time. So now let's talk about your valuations. One of the things I keep tabs on every semester is I look to see which companies get valued the most. These were the companies that were chosen by the most, so basically Peloton, five people valued Peloton. But I guess the fact that Peloton is going through these throes of a new CEO, new business model made it attractive. Netflix, Shopify, Virgin Galactic, and Coinbase were all in three. So if crypto is your thing, Coinbase is the logical place to go because it's one of, I mean, cryptos themselves cannot be valued because they're not assets, the currencies or collectibles, but Coinbase is a business. It's a business tied intimately to crypto growth, but it's a business, so I can see the attraction. Now, one question I was asked very early in the semester is, am I allowed to value, because you can see everybody else's company, am I allowed to value a company that somebody else has picked? And I said, be my guest. No, I don't care. And the reason is very simple. There were five people who valued Peloton. The dates are roughly around the same. The 5-8, that sounds like you're valuing still on Sunday, but no, I'll take you at your word. And one is a week ago. The prices, you can see, a week made a big difference in this class. If you valued a company 1 week ago, it might have been overvalued. Today, given how much stocks have adjusted, you might be undervalued. But you can see the differences in DCF value, ranging from 960. I haven't looked at the valuations. I have no idea what the story in the valuations are, but you can see that four of the numbers are around 30 and one is below 10. Their pricing is even more divergent. There's one pricing at $80. I don't know how there's optionality there because I don't think Peloton has much debt, but again, I'll take that for it. So it's worth less than a DCF value anyway, or more, less than the pricing anyway. There were four buys and one sell. We'll come back and talk about why when you have a company valued by different people, there is information in how much disagreement there is among people. It's not just what the consensus value is, what the disagreement is. But you can see, same company, very different conclusions of value. So I looked at your DCF value versus your price per share. Here's what your bottom line was. This is the breakdown of how your companies came out. There were 10 companies that were undervalued by more than 50%. I'll show you the list. There were about 17 companies undervalued 33 to 50, and you can see the breakdown all the way through. There were about 8 companies overvalued by more than 100%. Your median company was undervalued by about 9%. Just to give you a contrast, last spring's class, the median company was overvalued by about 17%. So I think the market helped you out here in terms of pushing the pricing down, but the median company is undervalued by 9%. You're saying, why is the average plus 66%? There's one company with like a 7,000% DCF value to price. So yeah, that's why the medians and the traditional metrics that are based in location give you much more reliable. So on average, you found your companies to be undervalued. There are still overvalued companies, but more undervalued than overvalued. In fact, 60% of your companies came out as undervalued, 40% came out as overvalued. And here's your list of most undervalued companies. Now, if you're in the class and it's your, you pick your company, I mean, remember at the start of the class, I don't know whether I made explicit this bargain. I always pick one company from this list to buy. You're saying, which one? Here's my test. I will, you know, if you're on this list as one of the companies, I want you to tell me whether you're buying. If you're not buying, I'm not interested. If you're buying, then I'm willing to make this joint wager with you and buy with you. Don't lie to me, though, because I might find a way to check you. But no. But if you're on that list and you actually have the conviction to buy, then I'll go along for the ride. It's the least I should be able to do, given that I pushed you into this, you know, value the company. So the most undervalued companies, according to this list, is Lyft. Now, I know $94 value, price per share. So I'm looking at the percentage difference. So the price is about 22%, which means it's undervalued by, you know, 400%. The value is actually 4 or 5 times higher than the price. So that's the list of the 10 most undervalued. Coinbase actually shows up on that list. But there's another person valuing Coinbase who found it overvalued. So there's a lot of disagreement on Coinbase as well. I'll leave that up for just a second. Now, there were some surprising companies on this. Rivian, which is this, you know, as you know, electric car company, pushed up. Amazon just took a big write down on Rivian. The price has dropped. So maybe at this price, it looks undervalued. But that's the most undervalued list. Here's the most overvalued list. Now, the three people who did Virgin Galactic, incredibly difficult company to value, right? It's a storyline is tough to tell. Is it in a leisure company? Is it a luxury leisure company? Is it a more commercial company? No, but it shows up on the most overvalued list. So, no. Interesting mix of companies here, old and young companies all showing up as most overvalued. Again, on percentage difference terms. Any questions on the under and overvalued? I'll tell you why I buy one of the companies on your undervalued list and why I'm not as willing to go and sell short on one of your overvalued list. I mean, this is what, 36th year I've been teaching this class. I've kept track of the undervalued list that comes out every year. I actually used to teach this class twice every year, so I have two lists that come out. And I've kept track of the buys, the sells each year. And essentially, so from the spring of 95 class, for instance, if you track the buys, the sells, and the middle is the S&P 500, you can see on average, at least over this period, the buys have done better than the market, the sells have done worse. But the sells haven't dropped, they've just done worse. Yeah? So I took a deeper look at the overall winning. We'd run a mutual fund, we'd look pretty good if we were able to transact at the prices that you saw on that list. So on average, there's something in the recommendations. 55%, about 60% of all buy recommendations do beat the market, but so do 45% of the sell recommendations. So it's not a slam dunk. And the excess returns vary widely across the successes. And this is true for all of investing. When you win on a portfolio, it's not because every company in your portfolio goes up. It's because you have a huge winner that pulls your portfolio up. So if you were at Microsoft in 2013, or Tesla in 2017. That alone can carry up your portfolio, and the payoffs are very skewed. I think that Microsoft came out as one of the most undervalued stocks in the 2013 list. Investing in that stock would have made up for a lot of mistakes on other stocks. So remember that when you have a portfolio, don't sell your biggest winners too soon, because if you sell that biggest winner and it's the one that's pulling your portfolio up, you could very quickly bring your portfolio back down to earth. And stocks that are undervalued on a DCF and a pricing basis do much better than stocks who are undervalued just on a DCF basis. Remember, you did a DCF value that you compared to the price and a pricing that you compared to the price. Stocks that did, and that's why I think even if you're a true believer in intrinsic valuation, it's worth refining your pricing skills, because they can still add to your success as an intrinsic value investor, because you've got two things working in your favor. Talk about pricing. Let's go through that four-step process, right? Define, describe, analyze, apply. Definitional test, make sure your multiple is consistently defined. Numerator is an equity value, denominator is to be an equity value. Numerator is an enterprise value, denominator is to be an enterprise value. And uniformly estimated. Something you ran into when you did your peer groups, right? When you pull the numbers, you pull them off the same database and the same variable. You couldn't use 2-year growth for some companies, 5-year growth for other companies, because you'd be mixing and matching. Second, describe, right? Draw histograms, use statistics. Don't use averages and medians and just rush with them, because they might not reflect where your company is. Then analyze. Anytime you ever have questions about a multiple, go back to a basic discounted cash flow model, not because you want to do intrinsic valuation, but because you want to use that equation to extract the variables that determine each multiple. And only then should you apply. Define, describe, analyze, apply. In fact, I pulled a page from the packet 2, where I took all of the multiples and traced them back to a common equation. Every equity multiple, you can trace back to a very simple equity valuation model, a stable growth dividend discount model. Every enterprise value multiple, you can trace back to a very simple enterprise value model. We take free cash flows, discount back at the cost of capital minus growth rate. So rather than think of these as 8 different equations to remember, which will be difficult to do, always go back to that basic equation, because then you can extract it for any multiple you run into. So I asked you to pick a multiple, and I don't think you're going to be surprised about what I'm going to show you. This is your pie chart of which multiples you ended up using. Half of you used EV to sales, some because of desperation, right? You have money-losing companies. You got to keep climbing the income statement. Next highest was EV to EBITDA. Price earnings and price to book are increasingly becoming that. At one point in time, half of all companies, people used to use PE and price to book, reflecting a different market and different sets of companies. You're starting to see them getting squeezed out of the process as enterprise value multiple. There's nothing good or bad about it, it's just different. And you get to have, you have to develop frames of reference that tell you what's a reasonable EV to invested capital. You can't just walk around with price to book ratios as your replacement for those. And in terms of pricing, I actually compared your pricing to your DCF to see how many of you got pricing that was higher than your DCF, how many lower. It's actually almost right down the middle. The median pricing was about 4% higher than your DCF. So this old mythology that DCF is always conservative and pricing is always going to give you a higher number is not true. You can see that almost half of the companies, the pricing was higher than the DCF. The other half, the reverse was true. And no, I gave you the choice of using either sector pricing or the market pricing. I think many of you chose the sector pricing, but between market and sector pricing, you can get wide divergences depending on the sector. So pricing is just, you tell me who the comparables are, you can get very different conclusions. And here I compared your pricing to the stock price. So just like I compared your DCF value, your median company came out as underpriced by about 4%. Which, you know, it should be pretty, you know, median pricing is always going to be closer to zero, because half, if you do your pricing right, half of all stocks will be underpriced and half will be overpriced. You're never going to get 80% underpriced, 20% overpriced, because then your pricing metric must be off. So you can see that it's almost split down the middle in terms of risk. Most underpriced stocks, there's the list again, and you can check it against the DCF list to see if the same companies are popping up in both places, especially if it's the same person doing it, because that adds to the power of the recommendation. So I'm just comparing price per share. They're all buys, which is not always the case, because sometimes you can get a company that looks cheap on a pricing basis, but you will choose not to buy because the DCF value is giving you a different answer. And most overpriced, price per share compared to your, the pricing, you can see that there's actually a few buys here because your DCF value must have given you a value that was much more reasonable. There were at least four companies where you had a DCF value of zero because there's no way you could actually bring the company above the value of its operating assets. And the only way you could extract value is by using an option pricing model. In a sense, you've given up on DCF, it's not pricing. Is hope you're buying it for the same reason you buy out of the money options. In fact, there were 12 companies in this class where people used option pricing models. There are 150 people. You can already see less than 1 in 10 people ended up using an option pricing model. Because you need two things, right? You need to be a money-losing company with a lot of debt. Getting one out of the two is not enough. So there are relatively few companies. And those companies, the option pricing model added a premium of about 29% to the DCF value. That's the allure of the option pricing model. It allows you to add that premium. So some of your, and most of these are distressed equities, equities in troubled companies, where something has to happen for them to become in the money. Now, once you have all of these numbers in front of you, I did force you to make a pick, right? Buy, sell, or hold. And I try every semester, I keep pushing people away from the hold because when you hold, you're kind of hedging, right? You're saying, I don't know yet. But you know, it's natural when you finish a valuation, you say, I'm not sure yet. I think it's undervalued. I'm not sure yet. The question is, when will you be sure? What do you need? Because if you just wait for absolute certainty, it'll never come. You've got to make a judgment on when you want to make that. Yeah. Second is, for some of you, this might have been an eye-opener because you might have come into this class thinking, picking stocks must be easy. Markets must be stupid. And you realize very quickly that you underestimate markets at your own risk. I mean, if you think about what markets do on a daily basis, it's actually amazing. Millions of people come together in a market with different perspectives and they end up with a clearing price. You might not like that clearing price, but there is a magic in markets. I tell people, look, you can disagree with markets, but don't disrespect them. You have to take into account what markets are telling you. And finally, if you had to pick only one stock, you're carrying the weight of the world on your shoulders, right? You have to be right. But let's say you do this on 20 companies. I'm not suggesting that that's what you need to do for this class, but let's say you do this for 20 companies and you find 20 undervalued stocks. You see how much easier it becomes to make a decision as you create a portfolio? Because you don't have to be right on every company, you just have to be right on average. That's why this whole notion of concentration actually cuts against you. It makes you much more reluctant to invest. Because you have to pick five stocks, you need to be right on those five stocks. You need more conviction, and it's very difficult to get to that point. Finally, your recommendations, 51% buys, 34% sells, 15% holds. So more than half of you, based on all of the different items here in front of you, the DCF value, the pricing, said to buy. And just to provide a contrast, last semester sells outnumbered buys 2-1, spring of 2021. Again, I think the fact that markets are down is playing an effect here, both in terms of bringing the pricing down and also making you more pessimistic. So one of the weird things about investing is when prices are dropping, you start to see people get more conservative. But percentage buys have clearly increased relative to percentage sales. I've never tracked that to see if it forecasts the market. Maybe I should take a look at that. But clearly you are more, you're finding more undervalued stocks than the people who were looking at these stocks a year ago. So let's loop back and think about these three different ways of valuing companies. At least let's pick between DCF and pricing. Which one should I use? First, it depends on what asset you value. Is the asset marketable? Does it have cash flow? If your asset cannot generate cash flows, you can't value it. You just have to price it. And how unique is it? If it's a unique asset, it's very difficult to do pricing. So those things play out. It depends on you. If you have a short time horizon, you're a much better candidate for pricing. Intrinsic valuation requires time, and you might not have time. It depends on why you're doing the valuation. Are you doing the valuation because you want to buy and sell in 6 months, buy and hold for 10 years? Are you buying a business, or are you buying shares of stock? That makes a big difference. And finally, what do you believe about markets? If you think markets correct, and they correct over time, you should do intrinsic valuation. If you think markets are right on average, but they're wrong on individual stocks, then pricing makes more sense to you. That's why I can't tell you what the right, you have to come to the decision on what works for you based on all of those things. So I'm going to ask you a question that I asked in, I think, session 2, after I described DCF. Now that you've tried your hand at DCF, you've tried your hand at pricing, and some of you might have tried real options, I'm going to ask you to pick, and you don't have to tell me, for yourself. And let this be a process where you come back and ask, do I still believe? So if you right now you say intrinsic valuation, I felt much more comfortable with that than doing pricing, that's fine. But come back to that, because that's something that could shift over time as you do this. And on the number telling and the storytelling, the number crunching and the storytelling part, I mean, I told you up front that, you know, one of my end games for this class was, if you're a number cruncher, I hope you develop enough of an imagination that you feel comfortable telling stories. I could tell some of you were not comfortable with the storytelling part in your DCF. You'd much rather have let the numbers drive the whole thing. And I had to push you, right? Tell me a story about why your revenue grew. Tell me a story. It doesn't take away from your number crunching skills. It'll actually make you a better number cruncher to be able to flesh out those numbers. If you're a natural storyteller and you want to just tell me a story, when I force you to use numbers, you're going to feel uncomfortable. It'll make you a better storyteller. So whatever your weak side is, work on it, because your strong side will take care of itself. So I'm going to leave you with some final thoughts about valuation. First, I mean, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Fundamentals always matter, no matter what anybody tells you. Ultimately, the fundamentals. I think we're in the midst of an adjustment to fundamentals. One of the things that I've found disconcerting about markets is the way people were willing to say inflation is going to be 3% and have a T-bond rate of 1.5%. Remember, we started this semester with that and we said that doesn't make sense? Well, something had to give. And that something wasn't inflation, it's T-bond rates rising. In fact, this entire market, I think, is going to be built on where will T-bond rates level off? If you think they've leveled off at 3%, this is steady state, then the bulk of the correction is behind us. But if T-bond rates are on their way up to 4, 5, or 6%, then we have a lot of pain in front of us. And that's going to be driven by what happens to inflation. If inflation comes back down quickly, then I think 3% is perfectly okay. But if it stays at 5% for the rest of the year, I don't see a way in which T-bond rates can stay at 3% with inflation. You're saying, who cares what the Fed thinks? Why would you buy a bond with a 3% interest rate if you think inflation is 5%? The Fed can't protect you from that 2% loss of purchasing power by doing it. So eventually, T-bond rates are going to converge on whatever inflation ends up being. Same thing with equity risk premiums. They started the year at 4.24%. Now they're at 5.2%. Are they done? Depends on what inflation does. If inflation stays high and volatile, I think equity risk premiums are also going to climb. What about earnings growth? Well, what about earnings growth? Again, inflation becomes the key driver here. If inflation stays high, the only way the Fed can fight inflation is by putting us not into a recession, but into a deep recession. That basically is going to break earnings growth. So everything rides on one macro variable right now. The rest of this year, we're going to be watching inflation. And people are going to say, it's okay. In fact, yesterday somebody sent he said, technology is deflationary, so inflation is never coming back. This is Kathy would have said the same thing. No, inflation is, there's no inflation anymore because we're, I've counted that. Tell me one item in your household budget where you're spending less now than you did, of substance, We're spending less now than you did 20 years ago because technology has helped you. People say entertainment. I used to play, $50 a month for cable, right? I have like 15 different streaming services. Don't ask me when I'll stop. But every time I, you know, somebody decides. I spend twice as much on entertainment than I did. You take every single item, supposedly technology is going to help us because it's deflationary, and you look at how much you're spending now, energy, food, housing. It's not technology that's made food cheaper. So I think that in a sense, you've got to be careful about these big macro stories of, hey, technology is going to change the old rules of demand and supply. Inflation has always been a monetary phenomenon. Nothing we do now can change that. I mean, sometimes returning to fundamentals is the best way to see what the answer is. Second, focus on the big picture. You know, there were a few of you turned in DCFs, where I'll apologize for how brusque I was in returning them back to you, because it's very clear that these were DCFs coming out of investment banks. 500 line items. I'm not going there with you, right? I don't know what story you're telling. You don't know what story you're telling. Your line items all are, in a sense, independent of each other. Here's the dead giveaway that you've lost the script. After 500 line items, you'll have after-tax operating income and free cash flow support, which are twice as high as your after-tax operating income. I don't care how many line items you got to get there. If you're growing and your cash flows are actually double your after-tax operating income, it's not going to happen. The valuation is just implausible. So when you look at these valuations, step back and look at the big picture. In fact, take these big valuations and compress them down. So even if you don't like the way I estimate reinvestment, take your spreadsheets and boil it down to after-tax operating income reinvestment based on your assumptions and free cash flow of the firm, because that's going to make you think about what doesn't work. What's the story I'm telling in this valuation? Third, a lot of anecdotes out there, right? I did this in 2018, it worked for me. I mean, remember, this is, in markets, anecdotal evidence is almost worse than no evidence at all, because it makes you do some absurd things because it worked the last time around. Finally, no, just remember, it's only a valuation. It's only money. So what else is there? Well, if your response is what else is there, you need some spiritual counseling, and I'm not in a position to give it to you. But I remember at the end of one of these classes like 10 years ago, second year MBA was graduating, came to me and she said, I never thought this would happen. She was a history major from Yale who came back to business school. Ended up being pretty good in valuation. And she came and said, I never thought this would happen, but I have a job as a sell-side equity research analyst. I said, my condolences. No, I said, congratulations. And then she said, I'm really scared. And I said, what are you so scared about? She said, what if I make a mistake? I said, be glad you're not a brain surgeon. Brain surgeon makes a mistake, somebody dies on the table. You make a mistake, what's the worst that's going to happen? Somebody gets a little richer, somebody else gets a little poorer, right? Think like a Marxist. You move some wealth around, the world hasn't ended. Just make sure the person who's losing out is not you. That's the only rule to follow. Somebody's transfer of wealth. There's nothing here worth losing sleep over. Nothing in investing is worth having immense fights over. It's just money. Which brings me to my final point, which is of all of the things that make you a successful investor, the most important is the one we never talk about. Luck is the dominant paradigm in this business. You can do everything right, but if you're not lucky, you're screwed. You can do everything wrong, and if you're lucky, you're going to make tons of money. It was brought home to me by my mother-in-law when she came to visit in early 2000. So she came to visit us. She would drive me crazy. At that time, I don't even think it was CNBC, some financial news channel. She'd watch it all day. The ticker would go at the bottom. She'd cheer it on. She thought, no, she said she was convinced that her cheering a stock on actually pushed the stock price up. She owned Cisco at that time. And then she let it slip that she owned Qualcomm, which in 2000, one of the great stocks of 99, up 600%. So I said, Judy, why do you pick Qualcomm? She said, I pick Qualcomm because it owns MCI. I said, that's not Qualcomm, that's WorldCom. She says, Qualcomm, WorldCom, what's the difference? I said, you picked the wrong company, something that rhymes with the company you meant to buy. But after she left, I did try a strategy out. Pick a company in the news, pick one that rhymes with it. You know what, if I'd made a lot of money, forget about this cash flow, intrinsic value stuff. It would have been the rhyming stock strategy I'd have been tracking. It just didn't work for me. Be lucky. Which means that if you're one of those superstitious types, always buy your Starbucks at the same Starbucks every day, the same size, because your portfolio seems to do well, don't mess with that. Even if you have to drive 200 miles to get to that Starbucks, get there. No, because luck is that unknown variable. One final point, and this is from a purely selfish perspective. I think your CFEs opened up yesterday, and I want you to do them. You know why I want you to do them? Because if you don't do them, you will not be able to see your grade in the class. And if you cannot see your grade, then you know what's going to happen, right? You're going to email me, and we're going to go through this conversation. I'm trying to save myself that mess. I think you have until Friday to do it. Get it done, get it out of the way. I'll send you, if you've never done your CFEs because it's something you just ignore, I'll send you the instructions, but make sure you get them done. But that's about it, and thank you very much for hanging in there. It's been a tricky semester with these masks, and many of you have been in two of my classes, one in Zoom, one in masks, so maybe next year we'll be back to normal. But have a good summer, and most of you are graduating. Wherever you're going, I hope you have a good time. Take care.